House come to order if members can take their seats.
This budget is a huge job maker, and the number one solution to economic insecurity is a job.
Hungry children can't learn, and it's our responsibility to try to help.
Equality and opportunity.
I believe most people are here because they want to do some good.
Welcome to Capital Ideas. The 2025 legislative session ended a few days ago, but we're not done yet with our semi-regular podcast. If we weren't here, where else could you hear members of the Majority Democratic Caucus in the Washington State House of Representatives sit down at the Capitol and talk about ideas? Today's ideas at the Capitol are courtesy of Representative Chapallo Street. He's from the 37th District in the heart of Seattle, just wrapped up his third year in the House, and in 17 years of Capitol Ideas, he's the first guest we've had who's worked as a professional soccer referee. There's more to him than that, much more, so stay with us. We recorded this Sunday evening, April 27th, 2025, just a few minutes after that final gavel went down, and here's what we said. Welcome to Capital Ideas for the first time, Representative Chapallo Street from the 37th Legislative District. I'm proud to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Just a few minutes ago, we ended your third session in the state legislature, and this will be the first time that people will get a chance, at least people on Capital Ideas, to get to know you. So let me ask you to just kind of give a quick bio and what you're about.
Yeah, sure. I grew up in D.C. and came out here after college and have been working at Microsoft. That's been my primary job. But I've been very fortunate that company treats you like an adult. They say, hey, here's some work to do. Get it done whenever you'd like to get it done. And that's allowed me to do a lot of things in the community and professionally otherwise. So I developed a computer science curriculum and taught that at Technology Access Foundation, which is a school in South Seattle. So I can sort of bridge the digital divide and make sure that people that look like me have access to an industry that's really changing this region. I was also a professional soccer referee, and so that was a completely different challenge, both sort of physically and mentally, which I really, really love and retired from back in 2020. And I also have a set of rental properties that I own and operate, so rather busy.
You know, just in the last podcast I did just a couple of days ago, the concept of digital equity came out.
Yep.
That's a phrase that I sort of inferred what it meant, but I asked for a description of it, and it sounds like what y'all do around here a lot.
Digital equity means different things to different people, and rightfully so. So like for me, I often think of digital equity as how do we make sure that underrepresented communities have the skills to first understand technology and use technology, but then ideally allow them to take part in these very high paying jobs, which often are changing the communities here. But digital equity also means access to broadband for people east of the mountains or in more rural communities. Having access to the internet, like so much of commerce is now transacted online. And so if you don't have access to it, you are at a very large disadvantage. And so I think digital equity and bridging digital divides is something that both Democrats and Republicans can both agree on because it affects so many of our different communities across the state.
You're the vice chair of the Finance Committee. That's a committee that's gotten a lot of attention this year because we started this session with a pretty large revenue hole. Tell me about your experience as the vice chair of this committee that has had so many eyes on it so intently.
Working in government is kind of interesting, especially coming from the private sector, where you can pigeonhole government into sort of large bureaucracies, not really understanding how it has an impact on people's lives day to day. But one of the things that I think everyone understands about government and it impacts them is taxes. Being on the committee that actually sets our tax rates has been incredibly humbling, because you know that the decisions that you make will impact businesses, will impact individuals. It's also how we raise the money for all of the great services that the government provides. So it is, to me, one of the most important committees, and in many ways sort of aligns with, I'm a geek at heart. I love numbers. I love details. And it's super important to understand numbers and details when you're on the Finance Committee. It's a area of legislation that I don't think sort of jives with everyone's personality. It does for me, and is super, super important, and really love the committee members. Chair Berg does a great job running the committee, and so it's been a pleasure learning from her. One of the things that I sort of made a promise to my constituents is helping us change our tax code. Washington State has one of the most regressive tax codes in the country, which means low-income people pay a larger percentage of their income than higher or more wealthy people do. And I think it's just sort of basic tax fairness that everyone contributes proportionally to our state in the services that we provide. And so that has been sort of a long-term goal for me serving on this committee, and this year we were able to take a step towards that.
I wish you the best of luck on that. It's going to be a continuing process for as long as I will live, I'm sure.
For sure, for sure. I mean, changing an existing tax code is a set of work, but also as our economy changes, we have to update our tax code as that changes. So we have a sales tax-based economy, basically a tax based on the sale of goods. However, many of our commercial activities are moving to services, which is not taxed or not taxed at a similar rate. And so there's many conversations we can have about just how do we change our tax code. But I think the tax code is a living and breathing thing that we need to be updating as our economy changes. And that, especially here in Washington State, where we have an innovation economy, I think that is even more important. So I think there's many different layers of sort of tax policy that we could dive into, which would keep folks on the Finance Committee quite busy for as long as we have a state.
Well, I'll ask you what might be a tough question now. The operating budget that you guys just voted on a couple of hours ago, it's a balanced document. It's a combination of cuts and revenue increases. How would you grade this budget? This is the second operating budget you've worked on. You had a supplemental operating budget to deal with last session. Where does this fall?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's hard to give a flat answer because I'm sort of thinking about this relatively. Past budgets, I've been involved in one full budget and one supplemental previous to this. And those environments were very different because we weren't looking at a budget deficit. And so while I was not over the moon with this budget, I think there were some very hard choices made and some cuts that will impact people. It is better than I expected going into this session. And so for that, I am very thankful.
There's more to you than budget stuff. And so I want to talk about some of those things, too, some of your policy bills.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Designed to improve, you know, individual people's lives as opposed to the budget, which is 8 million people. A couple of bills that you've got that I find really interesting. One is about cardiac intervention.
Yep.
A particular kind that I'm going to let you pronounce. That bill was signed into law, and I'd be interested to hear what the story is on that bill.
Sure. So percutaneous coronary interventions. I'll just refer to it as PCI because Lord knows neither of us want to say that mouthful again.
No, that's enough.
Yeah, it's similar to a stent that you put into your coronary artery and just opens it up if you have blockage there. And most hospitals can do this in emergency situations, but you can't necessarily do it if you just see that a artery is becoming clogged. It would make sense to do it proactively so that someone doesn't go into cardiac arrest. And with most procedures, when you do it preventatively, it is a smaller healthcare cost than it is once someone's in emergency and going to the ER. And so we have a hospital in our district, Harborview, which, I mean, I think we should be letting more hospitals do this proactively just for the betterment of our patients, right? Like so that people can get this taken care of ahead of time. But also Harborview serves 60% people who are on subsidized healthcare. And so making sure that we can do this procedure as cheaply as possible also saves the taxpayers money. So to me, this is just a win-win of like, how can we treat like people in a dignified manner so that we can get them the care that they need before it's an emergency, but also how can we be a better steward of taxpayer dollars so that when we are providing healthcare, it's at the cheapest cost possible. And I was happy to get that across the finish line this year.
So this just adds to the portfolio of what that hospital can do.
Correct. And like what's even sort of more crazy to me in this situation is that they are already providing PCIs in emergencies. It's just letting them do it preventively. So it's not like letting them do something new that's untested or something like that. It's like, you're already doing it now. Like, right. Why wouldn't you do it in this other case?
Yeah, go do it in that room instead of this room.
Exactly.
That room's a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
You've also got a couple of bills that maybe didn't make it to the finish line this year, but it's just the beginning of a two-year session. One is kind of timely given a lot of things that are in the news these days, and it has to do with the recycling of batteries from EVs, electric vehicles. Other than just saying, well, this is to recycle those batteries, how does this bill work?
I look at this as part of our transition to a greener economy. We're trying to electrify as many things as possible because we know that there are low carbon or no carbon sources of electricity. And the more we can utilize them, the better climate goals our outcomes will have. And so this is one step on a journey to deal with batteries, which is one way to store electricity. 2 years ago, we passed a battery recycling program for sort of household batteries, so like your AA batteries, your lithium ion batteries that power like handheld power tools. And then this year we came back for batteries that power electric vehicles. Hopefully we'll see more and more EVs on the road. And they have like really ginormous batteries. And creating these batteries takes a lot of energy to mine the minerals. And then at the end of the lifespan of a battery, we have to dispose of them. And if we just throw them away, many of them catch fire. There have been documented cases of these things causing fires in our waste streams, leaching dangerous chemicals into our environment. And so making sure that we can sort of have a comprehensive end of life of these things is super important to prevent damage, but also to reclaim those minerals so that we don't have to go mine some more and just keep those within the country. It reduces the price of getting those minerals to create new batteries. And so I think this is a win-win. We didn't quite get it across the finish line, but thankfully the industry has some pilot programs around recycling these things. And we've been trying to work with them to make sure that we can include the best ideas that they have from that pilot program into whatever legislation we have. Because it's really interesting, the sort of market forces around electric vehicle battery recycling versus regular battery recycling, like EV batteries. They're kind of hard to get. Like, you have to have a car, and then they're really hard to throw away. Like, you can't just pop the battery out of your EV and toss it in the trash can.
A lot of people wouldn't be able to pick them up.
No one can pick them. Like, they're usually like the complete bottom surface of your car, like exactly. 2,000 pounds or something like that. So it's a very interesting difference to household batteries, because there's fewer places you get them, fewer places you can throw them away. And so making sure that we can capture that in a program is one of the challenges of creating a good administrable set of legislation.
These kind of things take years sometimes. Yeah. So good luck.
Thanks.
Keep working.
I'll be working on it next year.
Another bill that sounds very interesting has to do with safer streets.
Yeah.
That's something that could benefit all of us, I suppose.
Yeah.
What specifically does this mean, making bike lanes wider or traffic lights bigger or what?
So we're trying to crack down on the things that are most correlated with road safety. So in the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen a record number of traffic deaths. So we want to make our roads safer. I think most of us saw through the pandemic, like, people just started speeding far more or more distracted driving. And those are really the things that lead to crashes and deaths. What we hear from our police departments is that they're understaffed and have a lot of priorities. And I completely understand that. And so I'd like to make sure that our police officers' time are spent enforcing the things that are most dangerous. An analogy I make is, if you saw someone walking down the street wielding a machete, you'd much rather our police officer go talk to that guy than write a ticket, a parking ticket. Because yes, while parking illegal, like, is wrong, and or if you have parked illegally, it is wrong, but it's not as big a problem as the guy with the machete. So let's go make sure that we address the guy with his machete. And I would analogize that to some of our traffic infractions. So yes, everyone should pay their tabs. And if you have time, like, sure, maybe we can pull someone over with like 2-year expired tabs who clearly is flouting the system. But I would rather have our cops spend time pulling over drunk drivers, pulling over distracted drivers, pulling over speeders. Like, I would argue that you could put a cop out on the road and pull over speeders all day, every day, and they'd have a job 24/7. And I went on a ride along with some cops, and they're like, it was eye-opening. I think we caught 3 drunk drivers and responded to 2 hit and runs. And so we were busy all night. Like, and that's exactly what I think our police officers should be doing. And the police officers handled it with like the utmost professionality. And there was another thing where drivers pulled over to the side of the road. We pulled over, helped the guy. So like, they're doing great work. And I think they have lots of work that is directly attributable to road safety that doesn't include things like pulling people over tabs, pulling people over for a 1 broken taillight. Those are all things that we can address. We can send warnings through mail. If it gets to an egregious level of multiple years of expired tabs and you're clearly trying to flout the system, then yes, let's talk to those folks. But there are many other more important traffic violations that we can prioritize our police time on.
I asked you a few minutes ago for a grade on the budget. I want to get bigger now. Overall, what do you think of the session that concluded just a few hours ago?
Yeah, I mean, this was a really hard session in so many ways. I think just the policy bills that we deal with are similar to my past 2 sessions. However, we came in with the context of the federal government and a large amount of uncertainty from the Trump administration. And so that automatically started the session off on a dire vibe, and we're always looking at the news to see what's coming out of Washington, D.C., so that we can protect Washingtonians in terms of the policy arena. Then we had the known issue about a budget deficit. And so raising taxes is always a very, very touchy issue because this affects Washingtonians, this affects businesses, this affects jobs. And we want to make sure that we do it in a balanced way without putting an undue tax burden on our citizens and businesses. So that is extremely hard in itself. And then we had just a string of unplanned deaths where our former speaker, Representative and Speaker Chop, died. A former House member who went over to Senate, Bill Ramos, he died. A senator's wife died. We just got a string of these sort of devastating pieces of news, which is even harder to deal with on an emotional level when we are trying to deal with so many other policy and monetary issues. So it's been quite a session. Many people say a session like no other. But it seems like everyone says that because my first year was right after COVID. And so we were filing tons. It was like, oh, we've never filed as many bills. And then in our short session, it's like, oh, my God, we filed just as many bills as we did during the long session. We've never seen this before. And so this year now we're like dealing with taxes and budget and deaths. And like, oh, this has never happened. So I am so looking forward to whatever one of these like normal sessions is. And maybe we'll get back to that. But I mean, there's so much need out there. And so I don't believe that, to me, I assume this is the normal where there are so many important issues that we can be working towards that it will always be emotionally taxing on us because we know the need, because we know there are issues that we need to be fixing for Washingtonians. And if it wasn't taxing on us, then we probably shouldn't be doing this job because we don't have the passion for sort of helping out everyday people.
Let me veer away from these strictly legislative topics for a minute and ask you about something that kind of surprised me when I saw it in your bio and heard you mention it. It's very interesting to me, the fact that you have been a professional soccer referee.
I think it says many things. Like, number one, it says I'm a glutton for punishment because there's only one thing that the 22 players on that field can agree on is it's that you suck. But soccer refereeing to me is really interesting because it is both a mental and a physical challenge. With other sports, there's a little bit more of sort of a cut and dry mentality where you see a foul, you blow a whistle, you see a foul, you throw a flag. In soccer, it's you see contact, you judge whether it's fair, and then you decide how you deal with it. That may be blowing your whistle and calling a foul. It may be letting play continue on if it's more advantageous for the team that got fouled not to have play stopped right then. How you call a foul changes. You may just blow your whistle. You may decide to sort of do a swing by and like chat with the player as you're running down the field and like, hey, I saw that. The level of language that you use, how you display cards, there's so many sort of interpersonal details that go into reffing soccer, particularly there's sort of two positions. There's the center referee who's sort of running around the field blowing the whistle, and then you have your linesmen who are calling offsides. Offsides is a much more black and white field. I loved the center because it had these nuances. You're trying to control 22 prima donnas to play a game in the constructs that you would like, and that changes every game. You're trying to keep all the players safe. Like, you're obviously not trying to get to a specific outcome, but you're trying to guide that game based on the personalities of these players and based on how these teams are approaching each other. So that's a very interesting puzzle to put together. And then you're doing that when you're dead tired. You are running 6 to 8 miles. You may not have all the information, right? You may be partially blocked. You might see a ball come in, hear a sound, have an idea where it hit. And based on the sound that it made and the way that the ball bounced, you then have to make a decision. And so obviously you're trying to put yourself in the best position to see everything, but that doesn't happen. And so some of these things are also putting those types of puzzle pieces together while you are tired, while you're physically exerting yourself. And so to me, it's just a super interesting combination of physical and mental gymnastics that you have to play to get the game right. And it's also super interesting because there you are applying a set of laws. Here in the legislature, I am then writing the laws that we sort of play our game of life by. And so that dichotomy of applying things that you then write is also just a sort of interesting comparison that I often think about when I'm here at the legislature.
You know, occasionally the Speaker of the House will hand the gavel to people who are not officially deputy speakers.
Yeah.
Have you presided for a few minutes over the House before?
I have not. And boy, that's one job that I do not want to do.
Well, it sounds to me in a couple of ways that stood out, like being a soccer referee. except you don't have to run.
Oh, no, it is. Like, I think it's actually a very good analogy. You're going to grumble and roll your eyes when I say this, but like, because I am a politician, and politicians are used to speaking and being in limelights and the center of attention. I actually don't like that. I would prefer not to speak. I would prefer to go behind the scenes and do work. And that's one of the things I liked about as a referee. Like, generally, we are invisible, and the better we do our job, the more invisible we are. Like, if we are clearly part of the game, it's usually not a good thing. And so I very much appreciated that anonymity as a referee, and being speaker up there running the show is sort of the antithesis of that.
What's on your plate for next session?
I think we'll be working on some of these bills and policies that we didn't get passed, like traffic safety for all. I'm also very interested in a state bank. I think that would help us leverage our money a lot better. So like when I joined appropriations this year and have been serving on finance for 2 years. And so I have a deep appreciation for how we raise our money and how we spend it. And so trying to make our tax revenue go as far as possible, I think is really important and would be a good service to our taxpayers. And a state bank would be one of those areas. And I'm optimistic that we can make that bipartisan issue. I believe it's North Dakota is the only state that has a state bank that is a Republican state, and it's extremely popular. So that's one of the things I'd like to – I know Senator Hasegawa has had a state bank bill for quite some time. I believe former Senator Cooter had a bill. So there's been interest here. I've been talking to Representative Rob Chase and Representative Lisa Parshley, and I believe there's another representative who had interest in this. So that's another example of a bill that or a policy that would take quite some time to sort of cook, and you have to get it right. But I think could go a long way towards allowing us to better leverage the money that the state spends on different projects.
It makes such perfect sense when it's explained. Bob Hasegawa, when he was in the House, educated me on this issue to the point that I'm capable of understanding it. And I just wondered, well, why doesn't every state do this?
Yeah, I mean, at the basic level, like as I understand it, a bank can leverage money 10 times. So every dollar of deposits that you take in, you can then loan that out for $10. And so we would be 10xing the money that we would be able to use for different projects around the state, which is great just to renew our infrastructure, but also great as an economic stimulus and create jobs and make sure that all of the good things that come with public spending can be done without raising taxes more on Washingtonians.
Maybe the most prominent policy bill that passed the legislature this session was one that's been in the works one way or another for years and years, and it has to do with rent stabilization.
Yeah.
Finally, the rent stabilization bill passed. It's going to the governor for his signature. You own some rental properties.
I do.
You voted for the rent stabilization bill.
Yeah.
Talk to me about wearing two hats there and how you feel about that particular bill.
Yeah, I'm a big supporter of rent stabilization. I think that being a landlord and providing tenant protections are completely congruent. Well, let's take other things that we passed previously, like not using convictions to deny someone who's looking to rent a house. That's something that I've practiced in my rental business. I've had tenants who have been convicts. They've actually been some of my best tenants. If we expect people to be able to have a second chance at life, they need a place to live. And upwards of 40 to 50% of our populace are renters, and they need those places. And so making sure that they can find houses just like anyone else is super important. In the case of rent stabilization, there are so many jurisdictions, states, cities that have rent stabilization and have thriving rental markets. I find it hard to buy arguments that that rent stabilization kills housing. That's just patently false. I completely agree with the argument that rent stabilization does not fix a housing market. Our market is fundamentally out of balance in terms of supply and demand, and we need to have policies that increase supply. And I think we've done a great job passing many bills that do that, from missing middle housing to repealing onerous regulations about building stuff. That's something that frustrates me. I have a property that I wanted to build an apartment building on, but it required 1.8 units of of parking for every housing unit, and that made the building not pencil because it reduced the number of units of housing I would have, that reduced the amount of revenue that the building would bring in, and it just didn't make it financially possible to do that. So by eliminating some of these regulations, we can attack the things that prevent people from building housing so that we continue to have a housing stream while still making sure that tenants aren't getting gouged in rent. Once you have a building, like if you have a single family house, you likely have a mortgage where your mortgage is fixed. And so, yes, while inflation may go up, the vast majority of your expenses are that mortgage and that's fixed. So even if your costs of repairs go up, that is a small fraction compared to the rent that you're bringing in. And so if you raise the rent by 20%, even if inflation's only 7%, you have made out. I just don't buy the theory from experience that you can't have very simple regulations around not raising rent at exorbitant amounts and still make sure that landlords are whole and even make a profit.
I know that this bill is going to be celebrated from Spokane all the way to the Pacific Ocean because it has been so long awaited and has had such good support from everybody except a majority of the legislators.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, to be clear, like this isn't going to bring rents down, and we need more supply to use market forces to bring rents down. And that's really what would help Washingtonians is seeing those prices go down because rents have gone up far faster than people's incomes. But until we get this market into somewhat more balance, we need some guardrails to make sure that people aren't getting gouged. And people talk about free markets, but all markets have guardrails, right? Like at some point in this country, we had kids working. At some point in this country, we had people working for no wages. We thought those were all bad things, and rightfully so, put some guardrails on our labor markets. Markets are intrinsically set up by humans, and yes, they can be free in terms of letting different participants partake in it, but we need to put guardrails around there to incentivize the kind of outcomes that we want from those markets.
It finally happened.
It did. Now it just needs to be signed by the governor.
Chipolo, I've had you in here for 35 minutes already.
It's flown by.
Yeah, I've enjoyed every one of those minutes, but I know that the session has ended. You've got to pack your office, I suspect, and go back to being a civilian at least for a day or two before
you have a job calling me.
Well, that's true. Tomorrow's Monday. So I want to give you a chance at this point to bring up something or nothing, whatever you feel like, that maybe we haven't talked about that you want to get out here. Some priority of yours that I knew nothing about and didn't ask you a question about?
I think it was really meaningful this year that despite having a budget shortfall, despite having to find ways to raise new taxes, our party was still able to stand by our principles and look towards the future. Like a lot of this budget was around fixing the issue now, but we can't not look into the future and mortgage our future so that we aren't making progress down the road. And an example that made me particularly proud about our party is that we found $300,000 to do a study on reparations. And so we know that there are impacts from slavery that have trickled down through the generations. I think it's a very interesting question about what reparations would look like in Washington State, because Washington State became a state after slavery. So it's not like sort of our 13 Eastern colonies that have been intricately entwined in slavery since the beginning of this country. But that doesn't mean that slavery was not a part of Washington's history, institutions, and policies. And so I think that's why it's even more important to have a study here in Washington State so that we can understand where those vestiges are and possibly find ways to repair that. And that was just one example of a way I think that this budget was forward-looking as well as taking care of people today. And I think we really need to find those ways to move forward in the future.
I'm glad we ended on something that important, and I wish you all the best on that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's like, again, that's going to be another one of those policies that we have to deal with for multiple years.
Yeah.
That's why we get to do this work, and it's just, it keeps you going.
You know, it's designed to do things slowly, but it's also designed to do good things. Representative Chipolo Street from District 37, I've enjoyed the heck out of this. This is the longest that I've been able to talk to you since the day you were sworn in as a state representative, and I feel enlightened and very pleased with this.
Yeah, let's not make it another 3 years. This is great.
All right. How about next year? We'll talk at the end of the short session and see if it felt long.
Great. Sign me up. I'll see you then.
Thank you. There you have Representative Chipolo Street. If being able to meet people like Chipolo isn't enough reason for you to subscribe to Capital Ideas, I guess you never will. But if you want to, you can do so on your usual podcast platforms or by visiting the House Democratic Caucus website at housedemocrats.wa.gov. Hit the media button at the top, then click on Capital Ideas Podcast. That'll open a page where you can subscribe, and while you're there, you can binge on past episodes. I hope you will, because what we talk about is your state government, and what happens here matters more now than ever. I'm Dan Frizzell for the Washington State House Democrats, putting people first since 1889. And if you have an 1889 silver dollar laying around, the one designed by George T. Morgan, it might be worth $25,000. Thanks for your time.